Okay, I think the subject to talk about in preparation for Tisha B'Av is to try to understand something about the Beis HaMikdash, about the temple. You know that I'm sure you're aware that what we are experiencing now, the time of year now, centers around the consciousness of this time of year, is centering around the question, the anniversary of the destruction of Jerusalem, the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. That's a hard thing to understand, so let's try to work on that a bit. You know, of course, the real problem is that, the real tragedy is that we can't feel the tragedy, right? The problem is that here we are missing something that we don't really miss. You know, two people who love each other and have experienced a relationship with each other, when one is missing, or when they're apart, do they feel the lack? They feel the pain. But it's very hard to expect someone to miss someone they never knew. So that's our situation. We are here supposed to develop a sense of tragedy about something that we never really knew. We don't really have any idea about what it is that's lacking. It's very hard to feel that. I think the way to approach that is to begin the study of what does the temple mean? What is the Beis HaMikdash? You know, is this a building in Jerusalem where sort of people gathered? Or is it something more than that? Let's try to put our heads into something about its meaning so that when we get to Tisha B'Av next week, if things haven't changed, then we will at least begin to understand the meaning of that emptiness. I think a way to approach it would be like this. There's a midrash that says that three people were named before they were born. Right? Let's try to understand that. Three people in Torah, maybe more, different opinions, but let's talk about these three who were named before they were born. Who was named before they were born? Oh, I wouldn't begin with him. I wouldn't begin with him. Who? Yes. Yitzchak is the first. That's good. Yitzchak's the first one whose name is announced before he's born. And there are two others. The Medrash says that there were three people whose names were announced. Their parents were told, or announcement, a prophetic announcement was made before their birth, what their names would be or what their names should be. The first one was Yitzchak. The second was Shlomo, King Solomon. And the third was a king by the name of Yoshiyahu. King Yoshiyahu, one of the descendants of the house of David, who in fact was the king right before the first temple's destruction. In fact, he didn't live through it. He was the king who lived in the generation before the destruction. And those are three people. It says, V'Yoshiyahu Yeshmoi, his name will be Yoshiyahu. By Shlomo, it says that what his parents would call him. And Yitzchak's life, his parents were made aware of what his name would be. And those are three people who are named. Then the Midrash goes on to say, V'yesh Emrim Yishmael, that Yishmael, the father of the Arab peoples, was named before he was born. That's a mysterious thing. What does it mean, some say? What is the meaning of that statement? Some say that he also was named before he was born. It's quite clear that he was. The information is there in Chumash just as it is there for the others. In what sense is there some say that he was named before he was born? Obviously the meaning is that he was clearly named before he was born. But the question is he included in this list or not? Right? That means, do you appropriately include him in the list that links the others, or ought he be considered separately? Try to understand this. First of all, what does it mean to be named before you're born? What does that mean? Let's try and go carefully through the layers here and understand this midrashic statement. What does it mean to be named before you're born? For that matter, what does a name mean altogether? What does a name mean? And what is a name that precedes a reality? A name is always a description of essence. You know that in Torah, a word, all words are names, right? All words are names. In fact, the Ramban says that all words in Torah, every word in Torah is a name of Hashem, no less. But a name is a description of essence in a way that puts you in contact with that essence. You know, a name is only needed for someone outside of the one who's being named. You don't need a name for yourself. You don't need your name. I need your name. If you walk, you don't walk around calling yourself by your name unless you're seriously psychologically distressed. You don't call yourself by name. If you lived alone on a desert island, your name would be completely irrelevant to you. Your name is for me. Right? Your name, you know, in slang, in modern slang, in certain quarters, a name is called a handle. A handle. A handle is something that you can use to get hold of something. Right? When you can't hold the thing itself, it's a point of attachment. A name is something that is a way of those outside of you making contact with you. When I want to call you, then I state your name, and that gives me a point of contact, not just convenience, but a point of contact with your essence. Actually, the word shem in Hebrew is derived, it's the root of words that mean essence. The word shem in Hebrew is the root of the word neshama, which means a soul. Right? Incidentally, the word shem, which means essence, name that specifies essence, is one of those amazing words in Hebrew that mean two opposite things at the same time. The word sham in Hebrew, which is the root of neshama, is also the root of the word shmama, which means desolation and destruction. Right? A desert or a wilderness, just like the word dibur in Hebrew, means to speak. And a desert is called midbar, a place where there's no meaningful speaking. Similarly, the word sham is the root of the word soul or essence, and also the root of the word for a place where there's no essence. You know that the word shem means a name. It's the root of the word neshama, meaning a soul. It's also the root of the word shamayim, which in English is translated completely inadequately as heaven. You know, you talk about heaven and earth. So in Hebrew, those things are shamayim and aretz. In English, they carry the connotation of heaven and earth. You know, the skies and the earth. That's not the concept. The word aretz means running. Not earth. It means running towards. And shamayim means destination. The word shamayim in Hebrew spells shamim. In other words, all the composite endpoints, all the destinations of movement that you could ever think of. So it's the essence of... The word means there. Sham, same word as shame, means there. Destination. End of movement. That's what a name is. A name is an expression that connects one to essence. It's not essence, it's outside of. But it expresses essence. That's incidentally why we have a tradition that parents name their children. When a child is born, we have a deep tradition, mentioned in many places, that when the parents see the child, maybe the mother, especially the mother, they're given a sense, and almost a hint of prophecy, that the child's name is their name. Now, that means that you have given a certain ability when you see the child. Very often parents plan a name for a child before the child's born. Plan a name. This child's going to be called, you know, Esmeralda, Marmaduke, Montgomery, you know, nice Jewish names. And then the child's born, and he doesn't look like Montgomery to them. He looks like Brett or Archibald. But there's a truth in it. The truth is that when you see the child, there's a certain gift that the parents are given of being able to bring down, as it were, bring down his name. The name is a deep connection with his essence. And that's why it's very significant. Now, what does it mean to be named before you're born? The concept is that the name is an attachment to the person that describes and states his essence. Being named before you're born is an amazing thing. Very, very uncommon, extremely uncommon, maybe very few people ever in the history of the world, that the Torah speaks about this way. It means that this person's path in life is uniquely aimed at destination. That this person's life, more than others, or in a particular sense, this person's life will move towards a concentrated destination with nothing being wasted. So much so that before he's born, it's already apparent. Normally when a child's born, the name somehow crystallizes around the child. And will he live up to his name, so to speak? His life will show. But a person being named before he's born, it means that the destination has been specified. This person's essence is already clarified in the world. And what remains is for his life to move inexorably towards that essence in a sharp way, in a way that marries journey and destination more intensely than usual. So let's examine that. If that's the principle. You see, the name has to fit the person. A name that fits the person before they even begin has to be a very powerful... You know, we say that name and essence have to fit. We say that, for example, where would you think the greatest marrying, the greatest harmony is between essence and name?
God himself.
Hashem's name, right? Hashem's name. So we say on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we say, Ata na'e l'shimcha, v'shimcha na'e l'cha. We say, you are fitting for your name, and your name is fitting for you. We say that about Hashem, right? We say other things too. We say, Havadai Shmoy. We say, Hashem's name is Vadai. Vadai means certain, certainty. That's how we name God. We say, your name is, of course, what we mean is, that our problem, of course, is lacking certainty, right? We don't see him clearly. So on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, when we try to make him king of the world, as it were, so then we work on that clarity, and we bring ourselves to the point where we want to describe him as certain and not doubtful. So we say, your name is certainty. And then we say that you fit your name, and your name fits you. The word na'eh in Hebrew, very hard to translate. In modern Hebrew, na'eh is translated as pleasant. Something's na'eh. But the real meaning of na'eh means that the thing is fitting. Pleasant means that the thing, a pleasant place is a place where it's the perfect place for what has to be done there. A name that's na'eh means... Now there's a strange incident in the Gemara that illustrates this. Some of you probably won't enjoy this. But I'll tell you anyway. The Gemara says, what does it mean, na'eh? Na'eh. The Gemara says there was a woman once, a woman who was married, and she was obviously very problematic, very problematic. In fact, she was such a problematic type that her husband eventually got to the point of making an oath, a shvur, that he had nothing to do with it. He had no, nothing to do with it. Unless she could show him something about herself that was na'eh. Unless she could show her husband something about her. It was na'eh, something that is fitting, appropriate. Well, apparently she couldn't. So she went to... She went to one of the sages at the time to see if he could find a way to annul her husband's oath. But since it was built on a condition, he had to try to find something about her that was na'eh. So he examined the woman very closely, asked her many questions, and evidently there was nothing about her that was fitting or pleasant. And finally he said to her, Biti, my daughter, what's your name? And she said, Lichluchis. Now, that is... I don't know how you translate that, but it's like it's a very distressing name. It means like, what can I say? Something, it's a very, very despicable type of a name. So you said to her, oh, that's Naya. That's it, that fits. And that's how you saved her. Well, you know, what you see, of course, this on the dark side, is an example of a name that fits. Right? This is it's a black on the black side, but nevertheless, that's the meaning. So somebody is named before he's born. The concept is that there's a fitting. Now the question to ask here, obviously, is if these three people, Yitzchak, Shlomo, Yoshiyahu, and those three, obviously, if they're all named before they're born, they must have something in common. There must be something about them and their path in life that fits them perfectly to their names in a unique way. If we ask the question, what do they have in common, you find that they're all centrally connected to the temple, to the Beis HaMikdash. Each of these three people represents a node in the history of the temple in a very intense way. Let's think that through. First of all, Yitzchak. Isaac, Yitzchak, son of Avraham Avinu. He is the essence of the temple. What happens to him? He's brought as a sacrifice himself in the place that will become the place of korbanos, of sacrifices. Let's try to understand this, right? You know that when he's a young man, his father is commanded to bring him as an oila, as a burnt offering. And in that amazing story, Avraham Avinu brings him and he builds an altar exactly on the place where the temple is to stand later, which according to Kabbalistic tradition is the center of the world. It's the rock from which the world spreads out, what's called the Evan Shtia means the rock of formation, of foundation. From there the world, the creation begins. He brings him to that place and he builds him his bech, he builds an altar, he puts him on it, he binds him on it. And then, according to the story in Chumash, he survives. It's a test after all. And he survives and he goes off to get married. And according to the Zohar, he gets killed. You know that the Chumash is always telling you a story on one plane, and the Zohar is always telling you what's happening in a deeper world. And it's based, of course, on a Medrash. The Medrash says that Ephrosh el Yitzchak, the ashes of Isaac, are always before me. In other words, although technically speaking he survives, but on the other hand, in some deep way he's burnt. His ash remains on the Mizbeach. What is this paradox? Does he survive or doesn't he? See, two things are happening here. On the physical plane, he survives in the world. But on the spiritual plane, he transcends into another world. Right? You know that the Zohar in one place, Tikkuni Zohar, says that the word Yitzchak, this name, breaks down into two words. Keitz Chai. Keitz Chai means death in life. Which means that he is the first figure in the history of the Jewish people, right? He's the first Jewish child, as it were. And his life is one that demonstrates what it means to live in this world of the finite and the limited and the infinite eternal world at the same time. Right? Of course, it's because of that that we become an eternal people. It's because that he is our father, who is an individual who lives in this world naturally and physically and yet has already died. Right? He lives the impossible. And that's why the Jewish people are a people. We begin where the impossible ends. And of course, that's why his name is laughter. Yitzchak means laughter. It doesn't mean laughing. It means he will laugh. Not now. This is what you call the last laugh, not the laugh throughout history. That's very problematic. The Jewish people have not been laughing throughout history. Our history has been one almost unbroken chain of disaster and tragedy. But what it means is a laughter in the end. And of course, laughter is a whole subject in its own right. But laughter always means the putting together of impossible opposites. Why is he called laughter? Why is Yitzchak called laughter? Because to live and die at the same time, what is laughter? Laughing is always the human response to impossible opposites that get, you know, what makes you laugh is always when two things are put together, when a situation is developing one direction and suddenly, unexpectedly and sharply reverses into an opposite course. People who are comedians and comics, they use that knowledge to make people laugh. They take a situation in one direction and at the time when you'd least expect it, in the most sharply contrasting way, pull it into an opposite, right? That is what laughter is. When you see that, when two incongruous things are put together, even if they're not intrinsically funny, most things that make us laugh, if you examine them, are not in the least funny. Here's a very tall, self-assured, conceited individual walking down the street, and at the worst possible moment, he slips on a banana peel and falls flat. If you smile at that, there's something wrong with you. There's a very cruel streak in you. And yet, even as you run to help such an individual, you can't help smiling because the incongruity. Well, here's a very respected individual of major significance, giving a very highfalutin, conceited lecture, strutting backwards and forwards in all his importance, completely unaware that a little child has pinned a bushy tail to the back of his suit. There's nothing funny about that at all. That's only childish and ridiculous. But the reason that we involuntarily laugh at things like that is because the incongruity of two opposites being put together. By the way, that's why laughter can only be human. You know that? Nothing outside the human realm can make you laugh. Laughter only generated by incongruity in the human. There's nothing a tree can do that can make you laugh. A tree cannot be funny unless it looks strangely human. There's nothing an animal can do that makes you that's funny unless it does something that's peculiarly human or should be but is not. It's always the human. When a child does something funny, it's only because it's incongruous that somebody that age could do something. Laughter is always the response to incongruity in the human realm. And the source of laughter is amazing. The source of laughter is the transition of greatest opposites. The source of laughter is the moment of death. Because there's no greater incongruity than going from a situation that looks like utter hopelessness, the end of all hope, disintegration, and yet on the other side, it's a birth. Of course you can't see it from here. The Geshe Rachaim has a famous illustration in which he looks at birth. He talks about two twins in the womb. And as the one twin begins to be born, the other one mourns. Because he knows that his twin is about to die. He knows that he's perfectly fitted for life in his mother. And he knows that when he's cast out into the external world, he must die. There's none of the features that he needs to live there. It's impossible for a child to live in the world. His whole anatomy is wrong. Everything's wrong. And as the child is passed out and leaves him alone, he mourns the death of his brother. Not knowing that this moment of birth is only the beginning of a lifetime. That makes pale into significance what they experience here. And of course, it's no accident that a grave is called a womb. In Hebrew, the sages, when they want to speak about the woman's womb, they call it the grave. They call it psichas hakeved, when the grave opens, when they talk about a woman's womb. What a strange thing to do. Because of course, that is the place, the grave is a place where the seed of a human is planted. And the Talmud says, you can learn the process of birth if that is what birth is. Can you imagine what the birth is on the other side of this life? Now you have to take it on faith. You don't see it. And that's why a person understands this deeply. A woman, for example, a woman of faith, a woman of greatness. Vatishak leyom acharon. She laughs at the day of death. Imagine that. She laughs at the day that's the last day because she knows that all of this is only a preparation. Why a woman? Because a woman goes through that in her body. A man doesn't know that. A woman in her own body goes through an experience that looks and feels like death of two people and turns out to be the giving of life. Incidentally, you know what our custom is? We sing that Eshes Chayil. We talk about such a woman. We sing about her on Friday night. As the sun goes down and Shabbos comes in, that's what we choose to sing. Why? Why do men stand up and sing the praises of their wives? Because she made Shabbos. She got very tired. She worked hard. It's because a woman represents the transition of the grave. Of being able to take what looks like death and understand that it's life. And Shabbos is exactly that. It's where the week enters the zone of Shabbos. The week is the symbol of this world with all its difficulty and ordeal. Shabbos is an existence of the next world. So the transition, the real birth, the messianic birth. There's a premonition of the messianic birth every Shabbos. The messianic age is called Shabbos. That's why we say, "Az yemalei schoik pinu." Then our mouths will be filled with laughter. Not now. Can't laugh in this world fully. You have to be insensitive to laugh fully in this world. But in the next world, and nothing funnier than that, when you see a world of destruction and torment and brutality and death, is only the necessary preparation for something else, like labor is for birth. And that's why Yitzchak is called laughter, because he's an impossible person. He lives in this world and the next world at the same time. In deep terms, that's hysterically funny. Do you know what hysterically means? Of the womb, incidentally. Think about that. But, you know, when he's born, You see, when Yitzchak grows and is offered as a sacrifice, and he then transitions into two worlds at once, that's why he's called laughter. But he's born in impossibility. He's born when his father's too old and his mother can't have children. The Talmud says she didn't have a child. She didn't have the home of a child. She had no womb. So when Hashem tells them you'll have a child, of course they laugh. They don't laugh in simple... They laugh at the deep sense of incongruity between the impossible and the possible. This child is going to be born where it's impossible for a child to be born. That's exactly what the Jewish people are. So he represents the greatest incongruity. Yitzhak is the person who represents death, that is life. Being impossible, that your beginning's impossible, and then not only is he born, but he's born of a... He's born in situation of impossibility, and he's a child who's born, whose eternity. That means the ultimate impossibility that he should begin, and he's born and lasts forever. And that is the secret of the temple. He becomes a sacrifice, not at the place where the Beis HaMikdash will be built. The Beis HaMikdash is the ultimate connection between worlds. It's the place where worlds connect. Let's understand that. First of all, what's a sacrifice? This is very hard for us to understand, sacrifice. Of all the things we have to understand in Torah, probably the most difficult. But the meaning, without going into fully, the meaning of a korban, the word korban in Hebrew means to make close, to bring into contact, to bring close. In English, the word sacrifice simply means the giving up of something. That's just one element of a korban. Korban means that you take the animal component that should be your animal component, and you bring it into contact with a higher world. Do you know what a korban is? You bring something to the temple which is eaten. Do you know that the idea of sacrifices... The Torah always relates to a sacrifice as if Hashem is eating. As if God is eating. What does that mean? All the language of Korban is Korban Ilachmi, the sacrifice, my bread. The Mizbeach is called Shulchan Gavoah, Hashem's table. There always has to be salt, like all meals have to have salt. All the laws and concepts of sacrifices are as if to say Hashem... The Nevi Shachaim explains that eating is always the secret of connection between soul and body. Why do we eat? Why do we eat? Why do we need to eat? Why was the world created in such a way? Because eating is the necessary energy that keeps the magnetic opposites of body and soul together. Body and soul are complete opposites. Nothing could be more opposite. The soul is finite, the body is finite and limited and earthy. The soul is a spark of infinity. How do you put those two together? One of the greatest mysteries in philosophy is how a non-material mind can move a material brain. Completely beyond human understanding. It's a genuine problem. How do you put together two opposites? How do you put together a spark of infinity beyond time and space into the finite space of a body? How do you take a spark of perfection and purity and put it into a body of contamination and excrement? Given to its own decomposition and its own... The human body, very problematic. You take the soul out, it becomes very offensive. Nothing smells as bad as a dead human body. Nothing when it decomposes smells as bad as that. Food is needed. If you don't eat, the soul begins to distract itself out of the body. You get faint. And if you don't eat enough, you know why we fast? We fast to allow the soul to begin to distract itself from the body. It's one of the reasons we fast on Yom Kippur, for example. We want the soul to be able to fly. When you eat, you keep the soul in the body. The more you eat, the heavier you eat, the heavier you become, the more you engage the body. On Yom Kippur, just as we step out of our shoes to allow the body to leave the physical world, the shoe in Hebrew is the same word as a lock. It locks you in. Similarly, we don't eat. We allow the soul to become free of the body. Eating is the energy that keeps the connection, keeps the soul in the body. Sacrifices, korbanos, are where the world eats. When you don't eat, your soul is not attached to your body. When we don't bring korbanos, the Shekhinah, Hashem's presence, is no longer connected to the world. That's the secret. That's why the world's in a bad state. Right? All we have now is substitutes for that. We're living on very, very thin diet, the world. The temple is the place of connection. You know, the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, has three functions. The mouth, where you eat, has three functions. The human mouth has three functions, three natural functions. Eating, speaking, and kissing. Three natural functions of the human mouth. These are all functions of connection. Eating is keeping the connection between soul and body. Speech is the connection, again, between abstraction and physicality. Speech is where you take a concept that is too ethereal, too abstract for you to experience, in mind, the secret, unrevealed world of my potential, and you bring it into the world of physical expression. That's what speaking is. Apart from the fact that speaking connects people. Right? The mouth, why is the same organ used for the same... What on earth is the connection between eating and speaking? There's a very deep connection. Eating is that creation that keeps abstract spirituality, soul, together with body. Speaking takes abstract spirituality, concepts, ideas, brings them into the body of the physical world of expression. And that's exactly what a kiss is. A kiss is the natural connection between spiritually bonded pairs. What does kissing mean? Throughout the world, the human world, with virtually no exceptions, the natural expression of affection, a mother's natural expression of affection for her child, people who love each other, man and woman, men, in many societies, men kiss, people kiss each other. What on earth does the organ of the mouth with which you eat and speak have to do with... You know, you obviously don't think this is strange. Because you grew up with this, right? The first awareness you had was with your mother slobbering their germs over you. You know, so you thought that's what... But if you look at this objectively, it doesn't make any sense. If you came from Mars, and I asked you to design a method of human intimacy, right? Yeah, these things are called humans. How do you suggest they show... You come up with kissing? It's absurd. It's dangerous. Medically unacceptable. Ridiculous. Maybe you should touch foreheads, rub the ears. You know, there's a lot of things you could thought of. The reason is the mouth is the organ of connection. You know, there's a very deep thing when the Talmud wants to speak about male-female intimacy, the euphemism that it uses is speaking. When the Talmud speaks about a woman alone with a man in an improper relationship, it says, Ra'uha medaberes, they saw her speaking. It doesn't mean speaking. In Torah, when you use a euphemism, you don't just simply use a word that means something else. You use a word that means something else that is the essence of the thing you mean in a more refined way. The Talmud, incidentally, in Tanakh, when it wants to speak about a woman behaving immorally, it either says speaking or eating. For example, in Mishlei it says, Achla v'machsa piyah, she ate and wiped her mouth and said, I never sinned. Not talking about eating. It's talking about intimacy. This, the mouth is the organ in the head of intimacy in the human form. Just like intimacy in the body, many parallels. Intimacy in the body is producing children. Intimacy in the mouth is producing a student when you teach. Yes. The relationship between a Rebbe and his Talmid is very parallel to the relationship between a father and his son. In the one case, he brings him with the lower part of the body, he brings the son into the physical world. With the higher part of the body and his teaching, he brings a child into the spiritual world, as it were. That's why your students are regarded as your children. Wasting words on a student who cannot learn is considered the same sin in Kabbalistic writing as wasting the power of intimacy in a non-productive fashion. The temple is the place of those three functions. What happens in the Beis HaMikdash? First of all, sacrifices are where the world eats. Secondly, where the world speaks. Between the two golden angels in the Kodesh Kodoshim, in the Holy of Holies, is where the voice is heard. It's no accident. And the temple is the place of kissing. The Talmud says that's the place, Denashki Shmaya V'aradani, where heaven and earth kiss. Because that is the place where the spiritual world makes contact with physicality and the creation begins from there. If there's one place you can feel Hashem's presence more closely, where it's more intense, as it were, is the Beis HaMikdash. This is the point of kissing, the point of connection. Do you think it's accidental that in the Holy of Holies, that secret private room, The two figures that are carved there are male and female. The two golden angels with the faces of children are male and female embracing. And when our relationship with Hashem is close and intimate, they embrace. And when our relationship with Hashem is distant, they face away from each other. Miraculously, even though they were one piece of gold. So the Beis HaMikdash is the place of connection between higher and lower worlds. And you see it in all the three functions. You see it in the fact that that is the essence. The Aron is kept there. The Menorah is kept there. The Shulchan. You know, the very fact that in the holiest sanctum of the Beis HaMikdash, you keep the Aron, which is the Torah. On the one hand, you keep the table, which is where the physicality is symbolized with the bread, and the menorah with the light, which is where the light of wisdom is. It's a point of connection between all elements of the world. And therefore, Yitzchak is the one who brings into the world the essence of what the temple is. Before the building is even built, he and the place are identified. He's brought there as a sacrifice. Not that he offers us, he becomes it himself. Talk about unity. That is completely locked into that reality. But no, do you know, it's an amazing thing. Yitzchak's midah is to be constrained. What's Avram's midah? Chesed. Chesed means going out of yourself. Yitzchak's midah means holding yourself in. What's called gvura. And when he sacrificed, what word do we use? Akedas Yitzchak. The binding of Isaac. Why is it called binding? Of all the activities in a sacrifice, by far the least significant is the fact that it's bound. You know why the sacrifice is bound? In case it moves. So the tradition is it's bound foreleg and hind leg together. Foreleg and hind leg together. And that's how Avram tied Yitzchak. He tied his hands to his feet. In fact, the Medrash says that Yitzchak begged his father to tie him. Because he said, if you don't tie me with a knife, I feel the knife on my throat, I may move and invalidate the korban. So tie me. But the tying of the korban is the least significant. The significant is putting it onto the altar, the taking of its life, the burning. And yet we call it like a... Because that's his essence. Yitzchak's essence is holding himself in complete and utter control. Not a flicker of a movement goes out. That's exactly who he is. And he is the sacrifice. He is the essence of what the Beis HaMikdash is to become. Let's move on. There's much more to say, but let's move on. King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech. His name before he's born. He's the one who built the Beis HaMikdash. Who could be more identified? Sure, his king, his father, King David. David HaMelech gathered all the materials and identified the site and made all the preparations. But Shlomo built it. He built it and brought it to its perfection. In the days of King Solomon, the 40 years that he reigned, right? He became king when he was 12. And he was king till he was 52. In those 40 years, the Beis HaMikdash was built and heaven and earth were perfectly connected. Of all Jewish history, there were only 40 years of peace and perfection. During those 40 years, there were no enemies, no wars. He didn't fight a single war, unlike his father. His father spent his whole life fighting wars. Shlomo Melech presided over a messianic world. There was perfect harmony. All kings and queens in the world brought homage to him. He married 1,000 of their daughters. He was connected to every aspect of the world. The Aleph Lecha Shlomo, it means all 1,000 elements of the world were subsumed in his... But he is the one, you know, the word Shlomo, the word itself, if you rearrange the letters, it spells Hamashal. Mashal means an analogy, an allegory. He wrote the famous book of Mishle, which means analogies, allegories. What does it mean? Says the Medrash, he was the one who gave a handle to the Torah. When there's something, that, I want to describe something to you out there that you can't see. There's no way you can see it. So I built you something here that's a model that's parallel to that. An analogy, a metaphor, a mashal. And from this, you get a handle on that. He wrote the book of Mishle. It's all handles. The Medrash says it's like a man who couldn't reach the water in the well. So he tied string to string and rope to rope until he had a long enough rope to dip the bucket into the deep well of wisdom and he brought up the water. That's what Mishle is. By understanding Mishle, you can get to the depths of Torah. He was able to connect you in his generation by his Mishalim to the depth of the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. The word Shlomo, if you rearrange the letters, it spells Hamashal. And if you rearrange the letters again, it spells Lemoshe. He's the one who connects you, Shlomo, through Hamashal, the analogies, connects you to Moshe. He's the perfect connector of worlds. No mystery that he was the wisest person who ever lived. Second only to Moshe. The wisest human, what does the wisest mean? That is most able to connect this world with the world of wisdom. And therefore, of course, he builds the base of Mikdash, he builds the vessel. So listen to the progression. First person arrives on earth whose name is given before he's born. That means his destiny is clear and his life is a perfect fulfillment of that destiny. He becomes the heart of the temple, the base of Mikdash. The second person arrives on earth whose name before he's born, builds the temple, builds the base of Mikdash, gives a home to that. And who is the third? Yoshiyahu was the king who lived just before the destruction. And he fulfilled a third function in building of the temple. He gave it the ability to survive in destruction. You know, it says, Yitzchak became the korban, the sacrifice. Shlomo built the building, but he knew it was going to be destroyed. He was a prophet. And he knew that although there'd be many years, decades of perfection, ultimately it would be destroyed. And therefore, when he built the Beis HaMikdash, he built an entrance to a secret system of labyrinths under the Har HaBayis that would always remain secret, so that just before the destruction of the temple, the objects in the Kodesh, inside the Beis HaMikdash, could be taken. The Aroin, the Menorah, one or two other things, could be taken and hidden away in that underground cavern. And with a long-standing tradition, there's even Midrashim and latter-day stories of people who found a stone loose in the Azorah where they knew they could get into the... Many interesting legends about it. People who found openings, said they did, were told never to say. But there's the opening to some cavern under the Har HaBayis, somewhere in the hills of Yerushalayim, under where the Beis HaMikdash stood, where just before the destruction, the objects in the Beis HaMikdash were hidden away, so that when the Babylonians destroyed the temple, they weren't able to take those things. In other words, listen well. When the temple was destroyed, what happened was its outer manifestation left the world. But in hiding in a cavern in the same place that, where no one can see, its elements still function. That means that when Yoshiyahu hid those things, King Solomon, when he built the temple, prepared an underground hidden cavern. When Yoshiyahu came on the scene and knew that the destruction was imminent, because he received a message from the prophet of his day, who was a woman by the name of Huldah. Huldah told him a prophecy that the temple's about to be destroyed, but you will be spared seeing it. Your greatness, the Torah says that he was an unbelievably righteous individual. Yitzchak, perfect individual, not a flicker of a movement outside what he should be doing. King Solomon, ultimate wisdom, life of perfection. And Yoshiyahu says the Tanakh, there never was a king like him who returned to Hashem with all his heart. Right? In perfect righteousness. And Huldah said to him, the temple will be destroyed, but your righteousness will prevent your having to live through that. And when he heard those words, he went and he took the Aron, and he took the Menorah, and he hid them and sealed them in the underground cavern. So that when the temple was destroyed, secretly it will still be functioning. You know, the Sfas Emes says something that is amazing. The Sfas Emes says that in that underground cavern, in Jerusalem today, where none of us have ever seen, the Menorah is still there, and it's still burning. The Western light that always burnt miraculously is still light. And when finally we're given the privilege of opening up that cavern, we're taking it out, it's still going to be burning. Only we don't see it. It means the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, is here, but it's in hiding. Hashem is in the world, but he's in hiding. Now, this is what you call Hestaponim. So the three stages are, first you have the building of the heart, that Yitzchak. Then you have the building of the building, the vessel, that's Shlomo. And then you have the donation, the contribution of the element of eternity. And that's called Yoshiyahu. He puts all the things, he takes them away from the Beis HaMikdash and he puts them into hiding, so that when the building's destroyed, we go back to having the heart, but hidden. You know, these three, it's no accident, these three. They represent, in the Ramchal's terminology, head, body, and lower body. Three parts to the body. There's the head, there's the chest above the diaphragm, and there's the parts of the body that come below the diaphragm. The head always means the place of potential, of essence. Thought, for example. This is where all is generated, but you can't see it. Then you come to the part of the body where you experience essence. Heart and lungs is where you actually live. And it's no accident, of course, that that's where your sensations are. When you have terrible fear, right, or tremendously warm emotion, it's felt in the chest. This central part of the body is where you experience life. Below the diaphragm, you don't experience life. Below the diaphragm are all those parts of the body that are continuity. digestion, maintenance, yeah, the liver, for example. The liver is the head of the organs that appear that are in the liver. The liver's function is to take food and make blood. Put the elements of nutrition into the blood, which is a function of maintenance. The lower parts of the body are all donated, are all dedicated to maintenance, enabling you to continue, and procreation, where you continue in a deep sense into the future. Even the legs are attached, no accident. The arms are attached to the center of the body, because the arms are the tools of expression in the world. The legs are attached to the lower part of the body, because the legs are tools of continuity. What are your legs for? Your legs are for taking you from one place to another. That's why the legs and the ability to have children have the same terminology in the Kabbalistic writings. The legs take the body from one place to another in the world. Children take the parents from one generation to the next in the world. A son in the Gemara is called Kara Davur. A son is called the foot of the father, the thigh of the mother, and the foot of the father. The father walks on his children. The parents, as it were, walk through history on their children. You have head essence that cannot be seen. Raw essence, unclothed in a vessel. That's Yitzchak. You have Shlomo, which is the heart of the thing, in a vessel, manifest in the world in perfection. And then you have the ability to survive eternity. Below the diaphragm in Kabbalistic jargon is called Netzach. Netzach means eternity. And that's Yoshiyahu. He gives it the ability, he gives the Beis HaMikdash the ability to continue even in exile, even in the generations of destruction, although we don't have the merit of living with it and seeing it, but he gave it its continuity. That's called Netzach. These are the three. The Ramchal calls them past, present, and future. The head is past. The head is the past tense. When I express something to you, there must have been a thought there beforehand. When I speak to you or give you a gift or manifest anything in my relationship with you, you can realize that before I did this, in the past, there was a thought, point of origin. The present is what I'm doing with you now. And below the diaphragm is the future tense. That is where I will be tomorrow, where I can walk, where my children will carry me. Those are the three dimensions. And therefore, the Beis HaMikdash represents these three layers. The three people whose names precede them, whose lives will be a representation of moving into the world and moving towards a destiny in perfect accordance with destiny. Those are the three people who build the temple in its three dimensions, which is the place of ultimate meeting of earth and its history and its destiny. The Beis HaMikdash is the place of perfect. What do the Chazal mean that Yishmael's name is also given? Yishmael, the final nemesis. The final exile will be the contest between us and them. The final exile, written in many sources. Yishmael's also named before he's born. He's also a being who moves into his own essence. You know what the word Yishmael means? It means Hashem will hear. What does it mean Hashem will hear? One interpretation means Hashem hears his prayer. But the Gemara says the reason he's named Yishmael is because through him Hashem will hear our cries. Right? Because of his activities in the end of days, we'll be heard. He is also a being who lives by his faith. Right? Tremendous faith. It says that when Yishmael was sent out into the desert with his mother Hagar, it says Avram Avinu took her, v'sam al shechma, he put it on her shoulder. What did he put on her shoulder? The simple intimation is a bottle of water. But the deep thing, Chazal say, ol shala emunah, he put on her shoulder the yoke of emunah. He gave her the essence, the secret of faith in Hashem. And she brought up a child with that. You see what they got from Avram. You see that the Arab peoples inherited from their great forefather Avram Avinu. They inherited his midas, hospitality, achnasas ochim, which he founded in the world, right? There's an inviolate principle in the Arab world. Faith. Do you find any place on earth today where it's more intense? And do you think it's any mystery or any surprise that there's a contest for the place of the temple with them? The temple is a place of intimacy. That's where we meet Hashem. Is there any surprise to you that they need to have a holy building in that place. Many Midrashim say there will be the final showdown. The contest over who belongs there. They're ready to defend it to the death. No question. And Ahishmael, his name too, is given before he's born. And he fits into this list in that sense. And that's a long discussion in its own right. But you can begin, I think, at least to see the connection. And therefore, these are some initial thoughts from one particular perspective. There's many other things to say about it. And understand how the Beis HaMikdash is a connector of worlds and what it means. Perhaps you just add one more angle here. You know that the place where the temple stands is called Zion. 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 What does it mean to be a Zionist? People think a political movement. It's something to do with Israel. Zion means a unique place. Zion lenefesh chaya. Zion means metsuyan. You know what metsuyan means in Hebrew? Distinguished, outstanding. Easily, specifically identified. Zion is like a monument, a place of identity. Zion means the unique place on earth. It means the place of the temple. That's what, to be a Zionist means that's what you love. The numerical equivalent of the word Zion is the same as Yosef, Joseph. The Medrash Tanchuma says, everything that happened to Joseph happened to Zion. Everything good that happened starts with all the bad things. All the harsh and difficult things that happened to Joseph. And it brings a long list of examples. Psukim, look it up yourself, amazing thing. They happened to Zion as well. All the good things that happened to Joseph in his life happened to... What's the connection? There were 12 tribes. What is Yosef's special connection? Apart from the unique aspect of being connected to the place of the Beis HaMikdash, in terms of his inheritance through his son or through his brother, that essence. But what's the connection between Yosef and Zion? Because, again, don't have time now to go into fully, but what Joseph represents in the Jewish people is intimate connection properly conducted in purity and isolation and covenant between male and female. Who is Joseph? Who is Joseph? He's the one figure in Tanakh who teaches us the incredibly intense bond between male and female that is completely exclusive. He is the one who spends a year resisting the seductive efforts of Potiphar's wife when he's only 17. He's the only man in Tanakh who's described with a woman's beauty. He has that. He's both father and son. He's the point of transition. At the point of birth, on the one hand, he's a tribe unto himself, Joseph. And on the other hand, he's a father of tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. No one else is like that. He is the transition from parents to children. That's the intimate connection of man and woman. And of course his place, of course he's identified with the Beis HaMikdash. That is the place of intimate meeting. That is where two golden kruvim, male and female, are embracing. That is the symbol, if you like, the intense, that's the symbol of our connection with Hashem. And therefore Yosef, that's his place. There are many other ways you can approach this. But the thought I think we should leave with is what we're mourning, the emptiness that we should be feeling. Right? And all we can begin to do today is generate some emptiness about the emptiness. That's all we can do. Is that there is a place which should be a place of connection. That place, if it would be fulfilled, if it would be built, rebuilt, if we'd have it again, not just a place to go, a place to daven, to pray. Incidentally, why does all Jewish prayer go through the Beis HaMikdash? You always have to face Yerushalayim, right? You offer a prayer to Hashem, you have to face that way. Why? He doesn't hear you any place. Any prayer in the world. King Solomon made Shlomo Melech davened that any non-Jew who davens to Hashem, who prays to Hashem through the Beis HaMikdash should be answered, unconditionally. Because that is the point of connection. That is where the two worlds meet. Obviously, that's where Tefillah goes through, in a sense. But that's the consciousness you have to have, is that that's the point of connection. It's a Kabbalistic mystery why you need a place. Why doesn't Hashem connect with the whole world? It's a fascinating and famous argument in Torah. Why doesn't Hashem connect with the whole world? Why does it have to be one place? two opinions. In the one opinion is Hashem should have connected with the whole world. The fact that he's connected only through the temple is a result of sin and problems. And there's another opinion that that's ideal. It's not a fallen situation. That's the way it should be. Why? I guess it's not appropriate now to go into detail, but real intimate connection, real intense connection, is very, very small in its focus. Just to put it in a refined way. When people are in love, the smaller the place of meeting, the better. The smaller the better. People are deeply in love. You can't crush them together too tightly. The Medrash says that. The Medrash says, when our love was strong, we lay together on the blade of a knife. What does it mean? That when we moved out into the desert with a relationship with Hashem, and we had nothing else. A desert means there's nothing else, only us and Him. So we lay together on the blade of a knife. That means husband and wife met. He and we met in a small tent of skins. Very, very small place. That's where the korbanos, the voice, the point of meeting, very small. We moved into Israel, crossed the border. Now the relationship is not as intense. You move into the natural world. You have to work in the natural fashion. A lot of distractions. There the temple was not a small tent of skins. There's a big building. And the second temple, when our relationship is much more distant, was twice the size of the first. Doesn't mean it's better, it means it's worse. The Gemara says people who saw the second temple, who had seen the first, wept when they saw the second. It was devoid of the divine presence. And now, of course, we have nothing. So you know what the Medrash says? When our love was strong, we lay together on the blade of our knife. When our love grew weaker, a bed of 60 cubits became too small. And now that our love has grown as weak as it has, Hashemayim kisi, the heavens are my throne, va'aretz hadam raglai, the earth is my footstool. Rabbi Avigdor Miller used to say, it's like a young couple getting married. You can't put them together too closely. Put them in a little basement apartment that's got only one room, it's absolutely fine. All they can think about is each other, it's no problem. A couple of years later, he moves into the east wing and she moves into the west wing. And they still cross paths too often. And a couple of years after that, opposite ends of the world. That's what it means. It means that this is the place of meeting. This is the small, humble, intense focus of meeting. Later it had to be bigger. It was more dilute, as it were. Then it got even more diluted. It was a place without a content. Now we don't even. Now all we have is the hidden reality. Okay, this is a few thoughts of introduction to the idea of Tisha B'Av, what the Beis HaMikdash means to us. And if we don't have it built and we can't perceive its hidden essence, what we can do is study, at least to understand. If a child never met a parent, parent left, child never met him, it's very hard to miss him. But at least he can study. There's some communication. Begin to know, at least in theory, from a distance, secondhand. That's all we can do. And therefore, we part with the thought that it's our job really to bring it back into revelation. It's by generating some point of contact, some understanding at least, that we can hope to begin the process of rebuilding.